Hello, and welcome to episode 16 of That Yoga Woman's podcast, a podcast where yogis, yoga teachers, and studio owners share stories of their lives on and off the mat. I'm Jules Buchanan, a yoga teacher and your host. This week, I'm talking to Amanda Bunton. Amanda is owner of Wild and Free Adventures, a surf and yoga retreat company which runs a variety of yoga-based retreats in the UK and abroad. She's now based in Devon, so on the doorstep of some of the UK's best surfing, but certainly that wasn't always the case. In fact, until a couple of years ago, Amanda was 5 hours travel from her nearest seaside. We'll find out what spurred Amanda to make some serious changes in her life. Amanda's been teaching yoga for 2 years, but has been practicing yoga for about 20, and she teaches primarily vinyasa and yin yoga. Amanda left her corporate career a couple of years ago with one of the UK's biggest retailers, where she was a studio operations manager. We'll find out how the creative flair and experience of managing photo shoots and in production helped her to brand her business and develop her market presence. Her retreats have been featured by Women's Health UK, as Best Yoga Retreat, the London Evening Standard Magazine, Om Magazine, and Carve Magazine, that's a surfing mag. So I'll also be asking Amanda how she works with the media to gain maximum exposure and increase her client base. As you can imagine, for a yoga teacher who runs multiple retreats per year, 2020 was a total kick in the teeth. She still, though, managed to host some retreats, so I'll be asking her how her 2020 was and what her plans are for this year. Not just that, but how she manages to plan and then cope with change when restrictions at the moment are so fluid. I was delighted she agreed to be interviewed for my podcast, as her Instagram is the height of cool and fun, but there's also clearly a sharp entrepreneur behind the surfboards and sunsets. So let's get going. I'm pleased to introduce Amanda Bunton to That Yoga Woman's podcast. So thank you, Amanda. Welcome to That Yoga Woman's podcast. How are you doing? Let's just first of all take a big breath in and then a sigh. It's lockdown. How have you been?
Good, surprisingly, considering everything. It's been an interesting journey, which has been, I suppose, both challenging but exciting at the same time. So I'm very lucky to live where I live in a beautiful area with lots of countryside space, and obviously the ocean nearby to go surfing. So
yes. You're down in Devon, aren't you?
Yes, that's
right. We're probably the furthest away that I've spoken to anyone. When I was back in Bedfordshire, I spoke to Eva up in Stirling. That's quite far, but I think Northumberland down to Devon's probably the furthest away. So thank goodness for Zoom, because otherwise it wouldn't be happening, would it?
Yeah. It's definitely been my, well, it's been amazing. It's been a lifesaver through all of this.
Yeah, I'm sure other video conferencing software is available, but now Zoom is proper household name. So I feel like I really want to go back to your days in retail. Would you call it retail, or is it more fashion photography? How do you see it?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I've never referred to it as retail in, you know, the 11 years I worked there. Because I studied art, specialised in photography, and then I always worked in the photographic industry. So to me, when I referred to my old job, it was very much, I work in the photographic industry. So it is that, because we were shooting photos every day. That was my role, to manage the studios and produce imagery. So yeah, I would say photographic industry.
So I saw some of your posts on your Instagram from back in the day. We're talking a while ago now. And your work environment looked like such a glam place. Models in nice clothes, like lovely backgrounds. To be honest, it looked like a pretty sweet environment. Can you share what a day in the life was like for you back then?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was glamorous, but it was also hard work. Just get that one out there. It was very different every day, and I wasn't always on set in the glamorous environment with the models, because my role being operational, I could be in the office, I could be around boardrooms, presenting all sorts of things, from figures to wanting new studios because I got too much imagery to shoot and needed more teams, you know. And I also had 5 sites. So one day I could be traveling to London, then I could be traveling up north to West Yorkshire. I had 5 sites, different studios shooting different things. So you could be shooting model imagery in one studio, then you could be shooting home furniture in another, And then we could be shooting children's wear still life in another studio. So lots of different people in the teams, from photographers, stylists, art directors, retouchers, production team. And I could be doing anything from working with them on set, or I could be, like I said, in meetings, you know, working through numbers. So there is no typical day. It would be wherever I was needed, and I would get in my car and be at whatever site and whatever shoot and whatever meeting I needed to be at. So it's a long answer to a very short question.
No, that's good. That's what I want in this podcast, to be honest. It shouldn't be the other way around. And just to understand, so that retailer, I can't believe there's five different studios. That's, I mean, it just shows you how much visual stuff there is in the retail industry to attract us to it. I can't believe that there'd be that amount of work to generate, like to go through five studios, but I guess that's how it is, right?
Yeah, and it was one of those roles where I think even both internally and externally to my role was part and parcel of that, was to bring awareness to what goes into producing an image. A simple t-shirt being shot for still life was never as straightforward as just getting the t-shirt, popping it on a mannequin or hanging it up with a hanger and taking a photograph, and then it's up online. There's a whole production. There is the pre-work that goes into it. What do you need to shoot in the first place? And then you've got to think about how you're going to photograph that and what timeline, getting hold of that item, which is usually in the case when we were shooting, so we had to get ahead of time, we had to produce the imagery, we had to prepare the website before it was even launched. So we were seasons and seasons and years ahead, sort of thing. So we were working samples. So those items weren't necessarily complete items. So that t-shirt, by the time it's actually produced and out there in the shops ready for sale, it could have changed and it's got a pocket on it. So, you know, we were like magicians sometimes. We would shoot all these items, and then by the time we got to the point of production where we would cross-check against final garments, sometimes we had to, you know, do some magic and retouch and put a pocket on a t-shirt.
Believe that. It's stuff that you wouldn't think about as a consumer. It's all that stuff that goes on in the background. You don't realize, do you, that happens? That's so interesting.
It's a time-consuming role. It's very exciting and rewarding, but it's hard work and a lot of effort into every single image. And that's, you know, not just still life, you've got model imagery as well, and all the challenges that come with putting items on a body, you know, that may or may not fit. With all goodwill in the world, you might get the model at the right sort of sizes and proportions, but human bodies aren't all exactly the same, are they? So, yes.
And I guess when there were issues with stuff like that, were you like the fixer, the troubleshooter? Did the buck stop with you on that, because you were in charge of the operation?
Yeah, it did. Although I did have a team of amazing people, from whether that's the creatives, the stylists, the photographers, or, you know, really solid, you know, management team that were capable to manage and deal with these situations as they came up. So if we had our items we were going to shoot and the model didn't turn up and we had to get a replacement model, you know, those sorts of things had to be dealt with there and then, and I could be on another site. But if something went wrong, i.e. something went online and it was incorrect, then yes, I had to work through, and my role as operations was to prevent these things happening in the first place, and part and parcel of my role as it grew was to build communication, come up with much more coherent communication between the business, because departments didn't necessarily talk like any company that you work for, and propose new ways of working. And we actually went from samples to working with actual garments, because it was just so much time wasted in retouching. Sometimes things got missed. So we then started working with physical items, but there was a shorter turnaround time then. We had to be quicker. We had to expand the team to deal with more volume to deliver that quicker and online.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. That's so good. So, I'm just thinking, because obviously some samples didn't even, I guess they wouldn't even make it to the final piece. Did you have that quite a bit as well, where a sample then just wouldn't make it to, yeah. And that's a whole waste of time then.
All that effort, the photographer, the stylist, the retoucher, the model cost, the everything, you know, and it might not necessarily be model cost, obviously, but it's a lot of work and effort. And that was what I would use then to propose new ways of working. This is the amount of money we spend on items that don't make it through and justified how we need to work differently.
So you decided to make the move from using samples to using finished garments, but then investing in quickening up the process and the speed.
Yeah. So that did mean expanding the team, which is obviously an additional cost, and the sites, which is why we ended up having so many sites and specializing in particular areas. So we had a studio that was dedicated to home furniture, because unlike mannequins or models, in the home world, you've got very large pieces of furniture, but then you've also at the same time got small items for your bathroom or your living room and soft furnishings, etc. So it's, again, a whole new beast. But you'd have to then come up with set builds, for example. So you're dealing with building a set as what looks like a home. So sorry to burst your bubble here, but when you maybe look through a catalogue and you say, that's amazing, that's a beautiful home. In some cases, it is just a set, literally a corner of a room that we've built. We've tiled that floor, all of that sort of stuff, put the window in, it's amazing. I mean, that was the side when I first came into the role that was new to me. I'd worked in fashion photography before, but the set build and the home side was a whole new beast, and it was fascinating. And it burst my bubble, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that is a bubble burst. I'm sure it will burst a few listeners' bubbles as well. I'm going to stick to like magazines and homes and gardens or whatever. And I guess I'm hoping they're real. No one burst my bubble on that if that's not real. So you were based in London at that time. Whereabouts were you living?
Well, I was living in Southwest London, but the studios I was working were Northwest London, so two opposite ends.
Lovely. Yeah. I bet that was a nice commute.
Yes. Well, luckily, because in the sort of production and photographic industry, you sort of don't necessarily work your 9 to 5 hours. I was on the road or public transport at times where it's quite quiet, thank God. Yeah.
And you were with that company for a long time, over a decade. That's quite unusual in this day and age, isn't it? Did it give you a lot of opportunities then to grow in the role?
Yes, yeah. And it was due to the nature of the role and how it kept changing every couple of years or even every 6 months sometimes, that kept me interested. Because I came from a creative background and started off actually, taking photographs, and then started to move into a more sort of studio management role. So when I first came on board there and my roles prior, I was a studio manager. So it was sort of managing the studio itself, not necessarily being involved in the shoots. But this role became very different a number of occasions. So I came on as a studio manager, and my first role was to set up the studio and bring the photography in-house. So that's what I was brought on board for. So I turned up to an empty warehouse, and the boss took me into, or my new boss at the time, took me into the warehouse, and it was just four walls and a ceiling, and said, right, so where do we go from here, Amanda? And then there's that big swallow that you do where you go, okay, I've run studios before, but I haven't set one up from scratch. So from day one, it was that sort of challenge that kept me going throughout my whole career. And they obviously figured out that I liked a challenge, because they kept coming back and giving me more.
That's how it works. Yeah. It's like with loading the dishwasher, right? If you like to load the dishwasher, you'll do it well, you'll keep doing it. My husband, when we did have a dishwasher, we don't now, loaded it once, crap, that was it, didn't get to do it again. So that's how it is. If you rise to the challenge, should have clocked onto that a bit earlier, Amanda, to be fair. So you must have had such a great sense of satisfaction when you'd had a successful shoot, beautiful shots. And I mean, that kind of photography is stunning. You could see them online in print branding. Like, how was that sense of achievement when you saw your stuff?
It really was quite rewarding, and more so for the team as well, because just giving you a bit of a hint in terms of some of the things that are involved in putting, that image together. It was, for me, one of my jobs that I wanted to take time on doing, which is not just necessarily receiving that, praise when I was in a meeting, say we've achieved our targets. I wanted that to be filtered back to the team, because when you know you've shot something 6 months ago and you've gone through the challenges, maybe that pocket on that T-shirt or whatever it is, or the model hasn't turned up, there's a whole story behind a simple T-shirt. So the satisfaction when you see it online, and say, for example, you hear from the product teams that it's been the best seller, and you realize that it might be a simple T-shirt, but there's not only a story behind it, but I shot that, I styled that, I was the retoucher, or I was the coordinator that made that happen because I had to chase down that item which was missing. It just gives you a flavor for, actually when you get to the end, what you see online might look straightforward and simple to someone else, to someone that's purchasing it, but is very rewarding to anyone that was involved in the process. So it is very rewarding. And we dealt with thousands and thousands of images a day.
A day?
Yeah, I don't know how we made it come together.
Sounds like hard work. You said it was hard work, but it does sound like a perfect blend of your expertise, that job. And it's not very often you come up with a job that does blend things that you love to do. Is that right? Was it?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think I came from a creative background, but I've always been sort of organized. I loved the studio management element. I loved the organization, bit of a perfectionist. So we kind of brought together those two sides of me into a role. I got to be in a creative environment, which was inspiring, but I liked the organization. I liked proposing new ways of working, coming up with, improving systems and delivering things. So it kind of, yeah, brought it all together into a role that did suit my skill set. Yeah.
And it was really clear when I was doing my little bit of research about you, Amanda, that you have like creative flair. You said like you studied art and photography when you left school. Has art always been a passion then?
Yeah, definitely. And funny enough, I've just been digging out my paints and my easel out of the garage.
Ah.
So I want to get back into that. And that's been inspired from some of my students who have been sharing some of their art that they've been doing. And I really used to love painting. And I haven't done that for probably, I don't know, 10 years, I think. Yeah.
It sounds like looking at what your students have done and been like, well, I could do me so much better. I'm going to get mine out.
It's more the fact that they were just inspiring with such beautiful imagery. I mean, I'll probably get back on paper and just freak out and draw a stick man.
Yeah, like stick yoga poses. But you actually, in just as an aside, when you do your class planning, do you do it with people or words?
I do little stick men mainly, and then yeah. I put a few little keywords every now and again down. Yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm a writer. And I can't be having the men because then I'm like, oh God, I don't know what that is. I look at it back. I'm like, I can't see what pose that is. I have to write the pose. Funny, isn't it? I'm going to ask people that now because I think it's interesting. But yeah, I knew what your answer would be. Oh, so, and then of course, your love of the sea and the coast. You studied art on the South Coast in Bournemouth and in Falmouth too. Was that where your love of the coast started?
It wasn't actually. It was from when I was a kid. So I was brought up, and my parents were creatures of habit. So I was brought up going to Cornwall every year. So we went to Tintagel, pretty much the same, I think, yeah, the same campsite every year. And although as I got older and got towards my teenage years, sort of had a bit of a grump thinking all my friends are off to, you know, sunny Spain and I'm going to Cornwall again. You know, actually, that's where my passion came and where I started to want to live by the coast. And so when I went to study, I knew that it had to be by the sea and it was either Cornwall or Devon. So I started off down in Cornwall, yeah.
So I usually ask people if they can remember their first yoga session. Can you remember your first yoga session? And what about your first surf session? So just tell me about them.
Yeah, well, I can't remember my first yoga session, which feels really bad now, but we're talking about nearly 20 years ago, I think. I can remember some inspiring yoga classes that I had. I loved a yoga class I went on, which was part of a retreat holiday in Morocco, which was done in a beautiful shala, and it was all glass and just overlooking the beach. So especially in the morning and in the evening, sunset and sunrise were lovely and, you know, all kind of drove me further and further towards where I am now. But I can clearly remember my first surfing session, actually, because I've always wanted to surf and for some reason didn't start till my early 20s, even though I went to Cornwall every year.
That's mad, isn't it? That you were in Cornwall every year and you wouldn't have been, and even studying in Bournemouth and stuff, you would have thought you'd have been on it.
I know most people think that, but the nearest I got to surfing when I was younger was a polystyrene surfboard that I used to float on in rock pools. But my first surf session was actually in Devon, not when I lived here. This was before I moved here. And we had gone on a holiday, a group holiday, and everybody was, you know, I think everybody bar a couple of people were all going to go surfing that day. We woke up, the heavens opened up, it was raining, it was windy, it was miserable. It was just a horrible day. And nobody, including myself, wanted to go surfing, if I'm honest. But because I had that drive and I was in Devon and I was finally going to go surfing, I got in that car and that determination drove me to the beach. Although I regretted the whole, you know, journey there, thinking, why am I doing this? Everybody else had ditched me at this point. Everybody bottled it and said, no. I'm not
gonna go. Just doing it on your own? In the rain?
Yeah, and it was supposed to be a surf holiday. I was the only one that went surfing. So I got there and I was also a little bit late and I just thought, what am I doing? Why am I here? I just didn't know. But I have to say, I had the best time. And when you're going to get wet anyway, it doesn't really matter if it's raining. And it's really nice when you're surfing and you're in the ocean and there's rain coming down on your head.
So in your first session, did you do the pop-up? Did you get it?
I managed to stand up, but I didn't do the pop-up. And the pop-up is a lot harder than most people think it is.
Well, I've done a little bit of bodyboarding / I've had a couple of surfers. It's like, well, actually, to be fair, it was prior to yoga. So maybe, you'll be able to say this, but maybe yoga would help that. Because, you know, up before yoga, downward dog position was never a thing. So now, like strengthening upper body, I guess it would be a bit. But it was just felt so far away. I was like, no, but maybe bodyboarding's for me. I can just catch the wave on my chest and be like, that's good. That's stuck with that then. But it's interesting that you were like, you managed to stand up, but didn't do the pop-up. So what does it take to get that? What do you need, do you think?
A lot of core strength, but also upper body. So you need your arm strength. And so this is one of the things when we do our surf and yoga retreats is obviously the surf and the yoga, they go together really well because you work on the muscle groups and the areas that you need to strengthen to get up to that pop-up, to get to standing on your board. And it takes effort, but everybody's capable of doing it. You don't necessarily have to have a really strong core. It depends on the waves that you're, you know, going on. And you can also not necessarily pop up. You can bring your knees through and get up, you know, slowly to the board as well to make your way to that standing position as well. So, and it's, you know, it's interesting because we have probably more yogis than surfers come on our retreats, and a lot of people coming for the first time ever surfing because that's the adventure part of them. And even strong yogis with a strong core, it's getting that understanding of the process of getting up and using those certain muscles. So that's why the yoga goes really well to support the surfing that they're doing on the retreats as well. Yeah.
So you make it sound so easy. I'm like, oh, I'm already swaying. Like, oh, I could go again. I could try again. It's worth it. I think I might after chatting to you about it. So how did Wild and Free Adventures come about? Like what was your vision for the company?
First of all, we didn't set the business up from scratch. I actually bought the business, and I was already sort of, this idea in my head was already sort of planted, the seed was there. I wanted to set up a surf and yoga business, and at the time I wasn't, when I was thinking about the idea, I wasn't a yoga teacher, although I'd done yoga for 20 odd years. I've done lots of courses and workshops and even teacher trainings, you know, sort of not the 200 hours. But I knew that's what I wanted to do, having been on retreats before. And then in the sort of years leading up to it, it just sort of all came together. So I was sort of talking and being vocal about what my future was going to look like, what I wanted to do. And I was on a retreat, Wild and Free Adventures.
Oh, you were on a retreat with them?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the previous owners, right.
Yeah, I'd been on a couple of retreats with them and it was like, this is mad. This is exactly how I would do the retreats, and obviously there was the blend of the surf and the yoga, not just yoga. And it's, you know, long story short, fate happened and there was an instant connection. We went on a second retreat, and it was after that second retreat with them that they then shortly afterwards approached us. And I had no idea, they didn't mention anything during the retreat, but they approached us and they were thinking of selling the business because they had lots of different ventures and different businesses going on at the time. And they wanted to move on and obviously heard what I was talking about doing. And I was prepared to start from scratch. And I was very, very, you know, grateful and lucky to have a business that was sort of, it'd been around for a couple of years beforehand. So I didn't set it up from scratch, but I took it on from where they started it.
It's just serendipity, isn't it? That really is. It's like you said, fate. It's just, that's so, like having that, or imagine you're on the retreat and it's like, oh, this is how I want my business to be. That, and then being able to get that business. I mean, that's pretty unique, isn't it?
is very unique. And I think we're still in contact with the previous owners, and I still work with Alan. He works on some of our retreats with us because he's actually a pro surfer, so he does surf coaching, etc. And I think, you know, I never would have dreamed that would have happened, but I will definitely say that when you set your mind on something and you really, sort of see that vision coming true. So when they say about meditating and manifesting your dreams, I mean, I was living and breathing. I was talking to everybody about it. And it was, you know, I think because you set your sights on something and you make things happen, and you know, things open up and opportunities present themselves. But you have to have your eyes open, because I could have not said anything on that retreat, and they'd have no idea what I was planning on doing, you know. And yeah, we've gone in a different direction, I suppose.
I love that, Amanda. You've just you've given me faith in stuff, like you really have, being open to opportunities. I think it's fantastic. That's given me a renewed sense of excitement for 2021. Better than we've had so far. So has your vision changed for the business over time, or is that still where you are now, like surf, yoga retreats?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what we specialize in, and it's very successful. But we did branch out last year, and we tried yoga and foraging, because a big part of our retreats is the food. So we're really into the food side of things. I'm not a professional chef or qualified chef by any chance, but I love cooking. So it was really important that the food was nutritious, it was healthy. Our chef is vegan, actually, and it's becoming more and more vegan. Even though it's vegetarian food, people are loving the food. So it's becoming more and more, like 90% of it is vegan. So we have a love for food and things like that. And I had this idea of foraging, thinking I'd love to learn more about it. And it was a family member that sort of encouraged us to sort of think about doing that. And we did. And we did our first retreat last year that was really popular. It was one of the retreats that had to be rescheduled, but it still went ahead later on in the year, which was fantastic. We had great feedback. And then we're doing that again this year, hopefully. So yes, yeah, so yoga and foraging is one. Also introduced a yoga and mindfulness one last year. And I'm, because of COVID, doing a lot of online retreats now. So, and that is including yoga and cooking. So taking that cooking element and the yoga, because you can't quite make surfing happen on Zoom.
No, that would be pretty tricky.
Yeah.
And how's the cooking? Like, do you tell people what ingredients they need to get in advance of the retreat? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So once they book on, they get an ingredients list and time to go in and source those ingredients. And then, afterwards, after the retreats, we tend to send them sort of the method afterwards, so they've got that to remember. But it's great fun. Honestly, it's a great way to connect with people. And if you have like family and friends you haven't seen for ages, doing it for someone's birthday, something like that. I'm organizing one for a group of friends, a private one at the moment. It's such a lovely way to connect. You know, there's one thing chatting and communicating online, but we're all connected online at the moment. So just having that little twist and doing something different and getting people that haven't done yoga before. That's great.
That's a bit of an interest. Yeah. Cause normally it would be, you get people that haven't done surfing before. Yogis tend to be your normal clients. So that's so good that it's opening up yoga up to more of a bigger audience.
Yeah, it's lovely, actually. It's really rewarding.
So just take us back, like how leaving your corporate job, how was that? Like, did you feel it was the right decision at the time? Like, it sounds now like you've got no regrets. Like, I left my corporate job, so far, no regrets. Do you feel like that?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, I was in the role for 11 years, and once I'd achieved what I wanted to achieve in that role, which was having the opportunity to build a studio from scratch. So following on from the previous question that you asked, I, 2 years prior to leaving, opened up a brand new studio. So this was a purpose-built studio, built from the ground upwards. So I was involved.
Yeah, so was this when he was like, right, here's your warehouse, crack on, Amanda?
No, yeah. So actually, I didn't get further than that, did I? So when I first started, I was brought on, given a warehouse and set up a studio from scratch, and then set up multiple sites. So what that was is setting up studios within existing spaces. So usually warehouses, because they're big spaces, they've got high ceilings and a lot of floor space, and then you can usually take the power that you need for photographic equipment. But the biggest achievement for me was being given the opportunity to propose a purpose-built studio, literally from concept to design, to build from the ground upwards. So literally, there's my square footage. That's what I need to build a studio. Here's the walls, the doors, the space, the height, the ceiling, and where the power goes and what paint I want to paint, the color of the wall, etc. So it literally, that was my biggest achievement. And it's any photographer or probably production manager's dream, because whatever space you're given, however big that warehouse is, the ceilings are never high enough, or the just space isn't just right. You know, still four walls and a ceiling that are set, whereas this was an opportunity to build something from scratch. And it was amazing to propose it, knowing the cost of building a building from scratch, and then being a specialist, you know, site. So, you know, with certain power, heights of ceilings, and, you know, the windows, everything. It was quite specific and unique. And then see that and walk through the door on the day that it was open. And I remember that was the point 2 years prior to when I left. I walked through the doors, and that sense of achievement, it was a lovely feeling seeing the teams there all excited, buzzing around these lovely brand new studios with all this new equipment, and we were getting ready to go. We had models coming in, and I just took a moment of sort of, you know, I think I've achieved what I need to achieve. And although I enjoyed the next 2 years, because there were other projects, because the bigger studio and all the things that came with that meant that we started to do more and more shoots and bringing more and more model photography inside, because we used to do still life, and then we started bringing on model photography, because dealing with people and a mannequin is very different. But yeah, so it was then at that point, for the next couple of years, I sort of set up projects, worked with departments, went back more into sort of working through more efficient ways to deliver more cost effectively, etc. And I kind of knew at that point I needed to move on. The creative part wasn't there for me anymore. I'd achieved a goal, and I wasn't necessarily on set all the time anymore. I was sitting in meetings talking about figures, and I, you know, it came to the point where I left, and it was the right time. It was perfect. And while I look back with fond memories, I don't look back with any regret of leaving.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good then. That's good. And your move to Devon, was that part of your master plan when you were like, right, I'm going to set up this business and it's going to involve a move to Devon, and you've made that happen? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, we didn't necessarily expect to do it all together. But like with everything, I mean, you know, they say that, you know, when you're pregnant and you have a baby, you decide to move home and do it all at the same time. It was a similar sort of thing. So, wasn't expecting to move to Devon at the same time as taking on the business and doing my teacher training. So all at the same time. But it was certainly a part of the vision, always to move down to Devon or Cornwall. And Devon was probably the goal that we were going for. So, it was part of the master plan, but it wasn't necessarily meant to all happen at the same time.
Yeah, so it was on the Gantt chart, but not in the right order. I hated Gantt charts. So on a personal level, you were engaged to Joe. Did COVID, or has COVID, put your wedding plans on hold? I'm being nosy now.
Yeah, no, that's cool. It hasn't actually. We've been engaged. We've been together about 16 years, probably been engaged for a good sort of 12 of those, I think.
That's a long time. That's a long engagement. That's a long time to be together. It's a long engagement. Like, I was together with my now husband 6 years, and the pressure was on massively. Not me, really. It was his family more. But then, and they went through a period where he was like, right, family, back off, because it's not going to happen if you're putting pressure on me. They did back off, thankfully. And then it happened. So that's a long, that's a super long time. Like, he must have been feeling massive pressure, or is it not like that at all?
No, I mean, the reason why we had a venue and we'd, you know, gone through the catering. It was all sort of planned, had the sort of all the details sorted. And then it was that difference between, we were in London at the time, whether we stayed in London for a few more years and spent money on a wedding, or we decided to move out of London and then, you know, do the wedding at a later time. And with that vision sort of in the far distance to kind of move to Devon, we kind of just chose the other. And then between now and then, we've moved twice. And then as we get to the sort of more recent years, buying a business, and that's kind of taken over. And then the little bit in between is we like enjoying going on holiday and traveling and things like that. So we like to spend money on those things rather than a wedding.
Yeah, spend money on your own, on yourself, rather than buying dinner for people for one day. No, I get that. That's so good. Oh, that's exciting. So what are the plans at the moment? Have you got any plans, or is it just... like wait and see what COVID happens, what happens with COVID.
Yeah, I think we're just gonna we've had to be quite reactive, quite creative last year. We've got a whole set of retreats lined up.
I meant with the wedding.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, we do. We've been talking about it since we moved down here, because we're now here in Devon, which is where we were planning on getting married. The idea is, yes, in the next couple of years for sure, because we're sort of 2 years into business now. So it's kind of like actually you can start to think about that wedding again.
And will it involve the beach?
Oh, of course.
Definitely. I was going to say that as a stupid question. And you've always loved traveling. I was just snooping around your Facebook and it says you lived in Australia and Switzerland. Now, I mean, there's no surfing in Switzerland. What were you doing in Australia and Switzerland?
I went to Australia. I lived out there for a little bit. And just towards the end of the time, I was working at, you know, in a local cafe. I was working as a photographer out there as well, just doing odds and different types of jobs and doing a little bit of traveling, but more living out there. And then a job came up to work as an au pair, but it was in the snowy mountains of Australia. And I had no idea there was snow in Australia. And most people I speak to go, what?
No, I've heard of like the Blue Mountains, but not the snowy ones.
Yeah, but it's purely that. I thought I was traveling, obviously quite free at the time. And I thought to myself, what a great thing to write on postcard. I learned how to ski in Australia. So that was my thought process at the time. And then I said, yeah, I'll take the job. And on my way there, I realized, what am I doing? I've never skied in my life before. I also came to Australia because I like hot weather, not cold weather. And then I rocked up and I was in these mountains in Australia. And to cut a long story short, fell in love with skiing. And then from there, after doing a season in Australia, went out to Switzerland to do another season and looked after another, I did another au pair job and looked after an adorable girl out there who I'm still in contact with, who's no longer a little girl.
Oh, that is so interesting. I'm so glad I asked the question. Who'd have thought you were in Australia and then you'd think, oh yeah, she does surfing, Australia. Yeah, no brainer. We know how that question is going to go. But no, you entered, you did skiing and then you asked why you went to live in Switzerland. Of course it was. Oh, I love that. So what did 2019 look like for you in terms of your yoga retreats? Like how many did you do? Where were they based? It'd be really good to just give us a picture of what your business was looking like at the end of, well, not last year, year before now.
Year before, isn't it? Yeah. So in that year we did six retreats. Five or six retreats. I can't quite remember exactly. And all of them bar one were UK and Cornwall. So they were surf and yoga down in Cornwall. And then one was in Fuerteventura. That was a week long retreat. And that was great. But that year we decided we wanted to expand and do more and was thinking about 2020, obviously, at that point. So it was a great year and met some great people who have become repeat customers and have still been joining us on retreats, which is fantastic. Yeah.
Well, you can't get better feedback than people booking again, can you? I'd imagine.
That's very, very grateful for that, yeah.
And so how many sort of like on a typical, I mean, were most week long retreats or did you have long weekends ones or what were they of the six? Were most of them week long ones?
You know, the Cornwall based ones are always long weekends. So either three or four weeks, the surf and yoga. Yeah.
But Fuerteventura was a week.
Yeah, because you've got to travel. So the idea is we want to always do one sort of trip abroad a year, but very conscious of air miles and, you know, what's, you know, our brand is all about is being, you know, eco-friendly and you know, you don't want to be docking up too many miles, but we want to have that trip to look forward to. But when you're flying somewhere, you need a longer period of time to settle into the new lovely tropical climates.
Yeah, exactly. And what sort of numbers come usually? How many do you cater for?
Well, part of the luxury experience that we offer is we do small groups. So we're not like a surf camp of 20, 30 people. We very much want that sort of personal touch. So anything between 8 and 12, I would say, on our Cornwall retreats. When we go abroad, they can increase, and some of them have the capacity to sort of go up to 15. But really, we like to stick around the sort of 10 to 12 mark, really, because then we can get to know people, get to know them and their dogs. And, you know, that's the experience we want to offer. We're not just running a holiday camp. We want to get to know the customers. We want to, you know, get in the water with them and surf with them. You know, we want to enjoy and make friends at the same time and make people smile. That's what we're all about.
So hang on a minute. People can bring their dogs.
I
was suddenly like, yes, this is amazing.
No, I just mean as in, you know, get to know people on that level where, you know, you do.
I was like, my Labrador is going to be running around. It'll be like on the end of my surfboard. I'll get the pop-up. He'll be there at the front of it. It'll be amazing.
I'd love to do dog surfing retreats for sure.
I actually saw this week, which is really inspiring, a lady with her Labrador, a big one like mine, on the front of her SUP. And I was like, I showed him the picture and was like, that's me and you this year, buddy. I don't know whether he could actually see it, but I was inspired. I'm going to, I've saved it as a favourite and I'm going to make it happen because I just love that. Like normally you see little dogs on the front of like kayaks or whatever, but it was a proper full-on Labrador. I was like, right, it can happen. She's inspired me. Why did you decide to host retreats as your main business, Amanda? What is it about a retreat?
Having gone on a couple of retreats myself and the feeling that gave me and the space it gave me, having come from quite a busy role previously and very, very hectic, I found that when I went on a retreat, it gave me, whether that was a weekend or a week, it gave me the space to slow down, stop, breathe. And not just the yoga, but the surfing element is very mindful, because when you're out in that water and you've got waves coming towards you and a big board, you can't really think of anything else. So the combination of the two, the yoga teaching you how to slow down, to meditate, to breathe, and to move the body and move that energy, as well as getting on a board and maybe dealing with it for the first time as a brand new adventure, doing something different, taking you out of your comfort zone. I think the combination of the two was the feeling I got from it was what I wanted to offer other people. It really made me feel good and made me step out of my own way, you know, get off the hamster wheel or rat race, whatever you want to call it. And if I could do that for other people, take them out of that busy environment just for a couple of days to give them some space to breathe and then send them back into the world of their normal, you know, job, career, whatever it is they're doing, and give them just a glimpse of how things could be, how they could slow down, how they could maybe look at how they want life to be, you know, moving forward. That was what inspired me. I wanted to teach yoga, but it was, for me, it was not necessarily teaching just yoga. It was giving people an opportunity to slow down, to stop, and like I said, breathe for a few moments. And it made me so happy and really gave me an opportunity to take a step back that I knew how powerful it was and wanted to offer that to other people. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. And so 2020 must have been an absolute shocker, like a total shock to the system, especially because things sounded like they were just, you know, going really well in 2019, plenty of retreats happening. Can you tell me how 2020 started for you and then what happened with the business?
Well, it started positively. We had sort of 9 retreats planned ahead of us. So we were very, very excited. Our first retreat was Sri Lanka, which was an amazing way to start the year. So off we flew to tropical destinations, had an amazing group, had so much fun with our guests. And then we started hearing all that was going on back in the UK, which was from a person responsible for people, that we're going to have to go back and we're going to have to get back into the country was quite daunting. But also being removed from that and not really sort of as connected as you would have been if you were back in the UK, it was a very daunting prospect. But we were very lucky that the timings that it kind of happened, although very close, we managed to complete the retreat, because I know of other businesses or retreats that were coming into the venue we were at directly after, were having to cut their retreats, or people were coming out 2 days and having to suddenly fly back to the UK. So we finished the retreat and we managed the situation well, and we were with our guests, and luckily we all had the same flight back, so we saw them all the way back to the UK. But that was a real a crash start to 2020. We arrived back in the UK to only know that 2 days later, inbound and outbound flights to Sri Lanka were were being shut off. So it was that close. And then within a week or two, I can't remember exactly, then lockdown happened. So 2020 started beautifully is the answer. And then very quickly after that, got quite real. So we got back to the UK and we had retreats in April and May. So we had to start talking to our venues and our partners about what the plan was going to be, communicating with our customers, keeping in very regular contact with them, because nobody knew what was going on, you know, whether you were a venue holder, hosting a retreat, or you were a customer. So we just had to really keep the communication going. And there were some people obviously very anxious about the situation, regardless of going on holiday or deposits and what's happening. You know, it was quite a daunting thing for everybody. So, so then we had to start those conversations. We then had to move into rescheduling those first two retreats. And one of them happened at the end of the year, like I said. The other one, unfortunately, had to be cancelled altogether. Then we were coming towards June and we were feeling quite confident, thinking, okay, right, we're coming towards the summer now. But June and September are our peak season. We have three retreats in both those months. So we were quite nervous, obviously, again, keeping in contact with our customers. But unfortunately, we did have to reschedule them. So then there was that sort of heartbreak to then all the effort and the time it takes to kind of manage the situation. So we postponed the June retreats to 2020, so this year. And then we were very lucky to be able to run any retreats. I'm very, very grateful, because September happened. We had a retreat in October as well. And then obviously previously the Sri Lanka one. But it was a real kicking the teeth, second year into what looked like a fantastic year ahead. Very excited, you know, fully booked. And we spent the first half of the year not knowing what was going on and rescheduling. So it was a steep learning curve.
And how did you manage as far as like venues, and were people quite supportive? Like you said, everyone at that time was worried, weren't they? It was that sort of permeating feel of nervousness and anxious, like anxiety. How did you get on with managing relationships with your suppliers?
Well, luckily we had good suppliers and good relationships with our suppliers. So our venues and partners worked with us. And, we were very grateful for that. I mean, there was points where we had to kind of compromise in terms of timelines. But really, really good. They were happy to transfer over when we needed to. And with our customers, where there was a situation where we had to reschedule, we were just very open with the communication and gave the option of full refund if they couldn't make those new dates. Because it's all good and well rescheduling a retreat, but people have plans and lives outside of what you're doing. So, Yeah, we were very lucky. We had good relationships and communication going with venues.
But it must have been so heartening to at least run some retreats in 2020, like you said. Yeah. They must have been, especially, I mean, I guess the Sri Lanka one early on, didn't really know what was happening, but the September and October ones must have been, were people quite nervous or was it everyone just quite relieved? That was a special time really, wasn't it? Restrictions were lifted, things were feeling a bit more positive. How did that translate to the atmosphere on retreat?
Well, yeah, we definitely had to deal with a couple of people who were nervous, even though we could travel and we could do retreats and we were COVID safe and had all of our risk assessments in place and communicated them very openly with our customers. I even offered to give them my 17-page risk assessment because I was so proud of them. people were nervous and there was a couple of people that came on the retreats and I talked to them quite a lot leading up to it. But once on the retreat, people were so grateful. One, to escape what was going on. They felt safe. We had some great feedback in terms of how we managed in the situation. It did feel odd walking around with PPE equipment on when you're serving people food and separating people, you know, because while the bulk of our retreats being outdoor sports activities, surfing outdoors, doing yoga outdoors, and I had a hall for when the days weren't great. Again, it was a massive hall. You could get 25 people in and I had, you know, seven people rattling around in there. So, you know, there's lots of space, but the eating outside, the eating part was the challenge for us because we had to keep the numbers down. We couldn't socialize and it wasn't a sports activity. So we had to separate everyone and it was al fresco dining. But actually what's turned out of that is the guests loved it and we're going to do that moving forward. It was, during that period, September is a perfect time to do al fresco dining. But the atmosphere was amazing. People were great. They worked with us, you know, with all the sort of COVID measures that we had to put in place. And we really enjoyed it. People were grateful and we were grateful for our guests and being able to run them. Yeah.
And how are you feeling with regards to stuff this year? Are you feeling quite optimistic, or do you feel like realistically you're going to have to cancel or postpone some more things? Like, what do you think? Like, how are you feeling now? We're coming to the end of January.
Yeah, we're optimistic. We have already rescheduled our second Sri Lanka trip. So that was due at the end of February. So that's now happening in November. So we were expecting that one. So we were being realistic about that one. And we spoke to both of our, you know, guests and our partners about this early on and involved the guests in the decision. Just basically said, should we just get ahead of the game? Do we realistically all think that we're going to, you know, we can hang on to the last minute, but, you know, we wanted the guests to make that decision with us. So that one we've moved. We have got retreats again, one in April and one in May. Who knows is the honest answer, but we're optimistic with vaccine being out and the way things are moving. Although we're still in lockdown at the moment, those precautions are there for a reason, to minimise, you know, future impact. And we hope we can. We're fully geared up in terms of COVID-safe business. And having done that last year, we're prepared. It's just the honest answer is we don't know. We really don't know. But we are feeling optimistic, yes.
And it must be so tricky with restrictions changing so rapidly. How do you approach planning and change? Like, do you have any strategies you can share with the listeners?
Have a plan B. Have a plan C. I think, yeah, have your risk assessments in place and try and think about all eventualities. We don't necessarily know what they are sometimes until they appear and present themselves. But have a plan B, have your risk assessments, be prepared to change and go with the flow. Because, you know, when we were doing our retreats in September, for example, last year, we were leading up to those retreats literally days before, knowing that anything could change the day before, during, or whatever. So we just kept, like I said, the communication going with our customers, being open and honest. We're all in the same boat. And that's the most important thing to remember, is you're not responsible and it's not your fault what's going on in the world. Everybody is experiencing this, whether that's with family, with other holidays, with venues, businesses, you know, whatever. So I think it is have a plan B and expect things to change and just be prepared for that change.
Good. Okay. Thanks. That's sound advice. Your retreats have been featured. I was really impressed. Some of your retreats have been featured in some really big publications, Women's Health, Evening Standard Magazine, Om Magazine, and Carve Magazine, which is a specialist surfing mag. So how do you approach marketing, specifically using publicity like that to raise your profile and attract more clients? Like, it's certainly an area I desperately struggle with. Where do you start?
Do your research, and from the perspective of running a business where I'm doing what I love. I love yoga, I love surfing, I love traveling, and I obviously like people. So do your research. You've got to think about the magazines that you read, potential clients would read, and then you target your audience. So, you know, for example, if you take Sri Lanka, we advertise that in Carve Magazine, a specialist magazine focused towards the surf side, because it is, you know, that retreat, while it's surf and yoga, is more focused on surf. So you have to really sort of target it that way as well. And we're quite lucky because we have over the time been approached by some magazines to want to do features on us, which is great. But in terms of advertising, one, it is quite expensive, and two, I haven't really found that there's a, you know, sort of a very clear way to measure that success. Unless you've got something like Sri Lanka and people are coming back to you and saying, I saw it in Carve Magazine, that's why I booked on, then it can be quite a big investment to make. So while early on in the year we did put investment into that, we have since kind of relied on things like our social media, where that's most of our communication or contact or exposure with our customers and how we sort of get our business out there. And yeah, we're quite lucky because we obviously take smaller groups, we get booked up on our retreats. So we've kind of taken a view that that from an advertising point of view, we are quite comfortable with what we're doing at the moment through our social media platforms, which is the connection to our customer base. And advertising is, it's a tricky world. It's a hard one, but you just have to really research, think about what your, you know, we have a clear brand strategy and identity. So, you know, that makes it easy for us in terms of knowing what we're looking for and also hopefully why we get approached by some publications as well. Yeah.
It's interesting. Like you say, it's a hard, being hard to measure the benefits, it makes it difficult to put your hand in your pocket, doesn't it, to put the money out there. If you can't, like you say, with Sri Lanka, if you've got a tangible someone saying yes, and then you can say, well, actually that booked out, that was worth it. Most majority of people saw it in the magazine. Then whereas if it's a kind of vague feeling that you're getting more exposure, there's some additional interest, but you can't count it to a specific ad. It's really challenging, isn't it? It must be, it's hard.
But it is important to keep advertising, getting your business out there to new audiences. It's the same with, you know, being, as we've spoken about before, you know, yoga teacher, you know, you want to get your classes out there and for new business to come in. But I think majority of our business is now becoming more and more word of mouth, recommendations. We have a lot of repeat customers, which, you know, is such a lovely, and we're very grateful to have, because you then run your retreats with people that you know, and they know what to expect, you know what to expect, but it keeps you on your toes because you want to keep it interesting. You want to keep delivering and giving them new things. So, yeah.
I imagine it's like a bit of a snowball effect though, isn't it? Once the word's out there to enough people, you get that repeat business, they tell their friends, they bring people, and then that's what you want, then to just keep generating those kinds of leads and people that really want to come because they've heard it's good from another person that they trust. That's the ideal scenario. So that's great that you've kind of getting there.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a really nice, it's very rewarding having that. Yeah.
What about brands? Because I've seen that you collaborate with quite a few different brands too. Can you just give us some examples of how that works?
We work with brands in different ways. So we work with a brand called Slow Active, who is a luxury surf fashion sustainable clothing brand. And we collaborated with them because we had the same ethos in terms of our sort of business. And, you know, we're it's important to us to be eco-friendly, ocean-friendly, and, you know, drive campaigns like plastic-free and that sort of stuff. So we work with brands that align with our ethos. And we worked with them to do a competition giveaway. And that was to win a spot on our Fuerteventura retreat. And at the same time, they offered up some of their swimwear, which is not cheap. So it was a really lovely prize. And that is another way of, you know, advertising, for example. So doing a competition giveaway, then you can, you know, get your audience out there and reach out to new people as well. So we've done that.
That's so interesting. So you're using the other brand, like each brand is using the other brand to combine and get a wider market.
Yes. Yeah. You work together with other brands in that way. And then we work with the Good Wax Co., which is 100% ocean-friendly surf wax, again eco-friendly. There's a, you know, an underlining theme with all of our brands that we work with. We don't just work with anybody. I also am collaborating with the Drunken Monk at the moment and doing meditation and yoga courses, should I say. So these are online courses that we've been doing during the pandemic and lockdowns, and so we're collaborating there. So I'm providing the yoga and the movement, and they're providing the amazing meditation. You should check them out.
No, well, that's it. It's just an understanding of how those types of collaborations work, just because someone who's never done, you know, would be approaching that. I've never done anything like that. It's just like, well, there's lots of different ways of working. And it's just trying to understand how, as a yoga business, that kind of even works. But understanding, like, you're sharing the skills with the Drunken Monk, bringing two areas of expertise together to offer something new to both of your customers. And then it's a similar kind of thing with the lovely swimwear, that you're combining your forces to then, like, expand your audience. That's exactly, it's just interesting how it works.
Yeah.
And like, is how we talked about the advertising, is it difficult to measure the success of those collaborations, or is it a bit easier, would you say?
It's a bit easier because you'll get that sort of direct response, whether, you know, they'll book onto that retreat because they saw the competition, or they wanted to be a part of the competition, or in the case of the collaborating online with the meditation and yoga, you get to know the customers. And then, you know, it's been great. I've had some of their customers now join my classes and vice versa, my students meditating more, which to me is the whole purpose of why I did this collaboration, because I was getting into meditation and I wanted to meditate more myself, but also share the benefits of meditation. But I'm not an expert in meditation. I know what I know and I do what I do. But the whole point of working with the Drunken Monk is one, I really appreciated their type of meditation and I wanted to offer that and expand it out. So when I see my students also working with the brands that I'm collaborating with, because I'm invested in them, it's a really rewarding process and it goes both ways. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. And you've been working on your website as well, Amanda. We both use Wix. Like, I'm not affiliated them, as are, like, neither are you. This isn't an advert or anything, but I think I'm really pleased with their customer service and the intuitive nature of how you edit your site. Like, what are your thoughts about it? Because as a yoga teacher in a yoga business, when you first start, it's hard, isn't it, to know what to do about a website, whether to pay someone or whether to spend the time and build it yourself. Like, what are your thoughts about that and Wix specifically?
Yeah, no, I agree. They have been amazing. I've never, built my own website before, so it was a learning curve. But to have a platform where you're in control, that's to me the most important thing, because, you know, it's good and well having someone to manage or create your website, but if you do that, you're relying on someone's availability and translating your vision. Whereas with Wix, what we both use, our platform, you know, I can create that content. I love photography, obviously. So if I want to update a photo tomorrow because I've just taken a shot on a lovely retreat, I can upload that image. You know, it's having it at your fingertips. But by no means is it necessarily an easy job. So there are people out in that industry for a reason, because they're experts. And like you and I have both spoken about, is how do we do this? How do we do that? But the customer service and the support that you get and how they guide you through that process, and then what you can learn by doing it yourself, and then knowing that next time you don't need to ask that question, it's in your control, is amazing. But you do need the time and you have to invest it. Yeah.
And also, like you say, the images are so important. Obviously, your website is absolutely stunning. And when I first saw it, without having researched your background, I was like, how has she done this? Like, the images are amazing. So beautiful. And then reading, obviously, your interest in photography, your art studies, your whole background in that kind of studio production, I felt a little bit better about what I'd managed to achieve.
Well, I have to say, I definitely haven't taken the photos out in the water. So the ones where people are on the surfboards, on the big waves. And some of those, obviously, Joe and I, my partner, are in those shots. So there are points where we do employ photographers to do that. Although I have to say, that's one of the things I would love to do next, is get into underwater photography and be able to get in the water and take those photos. So, yeah.
And like you said, like, investment in, it's knowing where to invest in your business. And I think sometimes photography, like, I had a little photo shoot, and I think it does help, doesn't it, having professional shots to promote your business. It does make a big difference.
Absolutely. It's an area that I would recommend everybody invest first, almost before the advertising, because, you know, like you said, your first impression when going on my site, and thank you, that's very kind of you to say, you know, it's first impressions are everything. So yeah, invest in the photography for sure. Yeah.
And what's next for you, Amanda? Obviously 2021, hoping retreats happen. What are the plans? You said maybe getting into photography in a bit of a different way. Yeah. Any other plans?
Getting back to painting, as I mentioned, which would be good. And looking at some, we've got quite a long list of either locations that we want to take our retreats or styles of retreats that we want to introduce. But they're sort of long-term plans, really. You know, expand the business, but take that slowly at the moment with everything going on, as well as take a little step back myself now as well and start investing in time for me. So getting those paints out and figuring out what I can do other than Stickmen these days.
And if you weren't a yoga teacher, what would you be?
I think there's a bit of an obvious answer in there, which would be photographer probably. But I think the other thing that popped to mind is a B&B owner. For some reason, in the back of my head, I've always wanted to run a B&B by the coast And I suppose sort of hosting and looking after people, it's a bit of a theme there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a step away. You're not like that far away from doing that.
Well, the ultimate goal was definitely own a lovely retreat centre in a tropical destination and run the retreats from there.
Manifest it, Amanda, yeah. It'll happen. So moving on to quickfire questions now. Don't put too much thought into these.
Okay.
We'll just crack on. Late to bed or early to rise?
Late to bed.
Oddest thing in your handbag?
Oh, I don't have a handbag. How do I ask that?
Honestly, I need to change this question because I think you're not the first person to say that. And I don't even have a handbag much now. So, yes. Okay. Well, who do you look up to?
Who do I look up to? Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I look up to my partner in a lot of ways.
Favourite film?
Favourite film? Dirty Dancing.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you?
How cool am I? Oh, gosh, I have no idea. Sometimes I think, oh, I'm doing all right, and other times not. I don't know, 6.
Mountainside or lakeside?
Mountainside.
Tom Hanks or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Leonardo DiCaprio.
What's your star sign?
Capricorn.
Who would you swap lives with just for a day?
Gosh, these quickfire questions, nothing pops to mind on some of them. Who would I? I don't know. I can't think of someone. It's gone blank. Who would I? I'll come back to that one.
Okay, come back to it. I don't think you can come back to it. You can come back. I'll let you come back to it. All right, countryside or city?
Countryside.
If you owned a yacht, what would you call it?
Gertie. That nickname that I have for things like kettles, it's weird. That's a Gertie, yeah.
What is at the top of your bucket list?
I want to go back to Bali. And it's a bucket list. I know I've done it before, but I want to go back there. I love it.
Describe your baddest and brightest leggings.
Oh, ones with a load of flowers on. Yeah, they're blue with sort of daisy-like flowers on. They sound hideous, don't they?
What's your favourite place in the whole wide world?
Oh, I think Cornwall.
Oh. Yeah. And your favourite yoga pose?
Oh, goddess pose.
And are we going to come back? Who would you swap lives with just for a day? Oh, I'll give you another few seconds.
I don't know. I really can't. I can't. My brain's gone blank.
Don't worry. That's okay. Yeah.
No, I can't think of that one.
I'm all right sitting here asking the questions. I wouldn't like to answer those. So you've done very well. So just lastly, I always ask, well, apart from the last podcast, which I got waylaid and forgot to ask my interviewee, but I always ask what music or sound for Savasana sounds or Shavasana would you recommend to listeners? We've had some lovely recommendations. So if you've got a track that you think people would like to hear, then now's your chance to share it.
Oh, it's really interesting. For someone that used to love yoga when I was teaching in person, I've gone to silence and Shavasana specifically. I tend to switch off the music if I did have any music on. But if I was going to use music, it would be sounds of nature or drums. Yeah, okay. But I wouldn't think of a particular artist or anything. It's just, it'll change. But like I said, silence is the one for me at the moment. Listen to your breath.
Indeed. Oh, well, that's a nice note to finish on. Thank you so much for speaking to me, Amanda. Please feel free to contact Amanda to share your thoughts on this podcast with her. You can contact her on @worldandfreeadventures on Instagram and her other social media. And if you've got any direct questions about her retreats or yoga classes, please email her on worldandfreeadventures@gmail.com. Thank you so much, Amanda. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
You've been listening to That Yoga Woman's podcast with me, Jules Buchanan. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it, share it on social media, rate it, write a nice review, and subscribe to That Yoga Woman's podcast. Links and information can be found on the episode page in the podcast section of my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/podcast. If you'd like to show some support for the podcast, you can do that through PayPal. The donation link is www.paypal.me/thatyogawoman. The last thing I'll mention is my line of organic cotton yoga-inspired tops. I designed a small range of vests, tees and sweatshirts that are perfect to teach or do yoga in. Have a look online, check out my shop on my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/shop. Have a look around my store and make an order. See you soon.